Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Metal detectors, police officers, see-through backpacks, run, hide, fight training. School administrators have embraced all of these strategies and more since 1999, when two students killed 12 of their classmates and a teacher at a Colorado high school. The idea is to prevent more shootings and ease the anxiety of students and their parents, but a recent study out of the University of Chicago revealed that most parents are still worried. We're talking about the long-term effects of school shootings and how they have changed the culture. Arash Javanbak is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Wayne State University in Michigan. He studies the negative effects of trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
School shootings have become a norm in our society now. March for Lives put out a television ad recently with a young girl teaching a room of adults how to handle an active shooter situation. Here's a clip.
Our teacher used to sing a song to make it easy to remember. Lockdown, lockdown, let's all hide. Lock the doors and stay inside. Crouch on down, don't make a sound. And don't cry or you'll be found.
And I guess I wonder from listening to that how we got to this point where we're having these kinds of scenarios play out.
Well, so my first emotional reaction actually to listening to this was sadness. And sadness because, this seems to have become a necessary part of training our children to stay safe, but sad because a child at that developmental stage is learning about the world, is learning about how safe and how comfortable and how trusting and trustworthy the world is. And now part of her education is, it's not a safe place. Even if you're in a school where what's supposed to be you are near friends and you're near the teachers who are the best people to take care of you, but you're not safe in this environment. So the change in the culture that has happened is that people barely feel safe in any context because we have when it comes to fear, if I want to like put my scientist hat on, fear is context dependent, meaning that if I am in a combat zone and I see military attire, I may be scared. But seeing all that military attire in a military parade will not feel scary to me because I feel my brain can understand I'm in a different and safe context. But now every time a shooting or such a disaster happens in a new environment, whether it's a church or a school or at a workplace, then that new environment is on the list of places that can be unsafe. Those are now on the list of the places that a person can get killed. So basically, we walk in and step into the places and buildings that we would not have to worry about something bad happening, and now there's a chance that may happen to us.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Wayne State University Professor of Psychiatry, Arash Javanbak. He studies these issues that we're talking about now, that is the impact of the violence of mass shootings on society. If you have a question or comment this hour, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, when I heard about the shooting in the recent shooting at the municipal building in Virginia, mm-hmm. I thought I immediately kind of took my temperature and wondered and compared it to what I felt and how I was feeling when I heard about the Columbine shooting in 1999. I was at work. I was an editorial writer. I was at work. I was in my office at the newspaper. And I remember it very well. You know, you kind of remember where you were at that moment. And I just didn't feel the same stress and shock over the Virginia one. And I was just trying to be honest with myself. I didn't feel that same stress and anxiety and shock, but I'm wondering what's really happening underneath it all. Am I still being shocked by it, but I just don't feel it the same way?
Well, I think there are a few differences here. I first I want to apologize if you hear back in the background my dog barking, but
it's okay.
So there's just to light it up a little bit. So one is like a shooting in a killing of children always triggers us most.
Yeah.
Because those are the group of, that's the group, the most vulnerable group of us that we need to protect and we feel responsible for protecting. But you are also right that we get desensitized to negative stimuli of any kind, and that's how the descent of a lot of societies or groups or people happens. Like people who gradually get exposed to violence can end up at one day being a violent person. People who are exposed, let's say they have a gang member friend, and gradually they go to the gang parties and hang out with them and want to see guns, and then they see some shootings and then target practice, and then someone gets injured, and gradually they may become a person who is holding the gun shooting at other people. So in the in a similar sense, we do become desensitized and lose our that shock factor about negative experiences when we are frequently exposed to them. It becomes a sad normal norm, which is not norm as normal, but is norm as something that is happening every day. But still, there is that negative emotional reaction always inside of us too. It may be cognitively now also softened by the way we react. But hearing actually, so that events traumatize those people who are in it,
mm-hmm.
which we can talk about later, about like what are the impacts of these traumatic experiences on these children, whether it's PTSD, depression, anxiety, other physical symptoms, and how it lasts throughout the life into adulthood, and actually their children.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that particularly. I read an article in The Conversation that you wrote, and you mentioned that it can carry on into future generations, particularly if the person is traumatized directly as a child.
Yes, so during the childhood, the brain is developing and evolving, both physically and mentally, and it is learning about the world and the universe. And the first encounters with the parents and the caregivers, and they give us a perspective of how safe or unsafe the world is and how fair or unfair the world is based on the way they behave to us and based on the way they look at the world. If my mom is always worried about my older sister that was going to school, I see it as a little kid evolving and developing, and I learned that schools may not be the safest places to be at. And when the child himself or herself is exposed to these traumatic experiences, which are often very common, whether it's shooting or other traumatic experiences, the person may develop what we call post-traumatic stress disorder, which is basically a constellation of symptoms. Brain goes to the fight and flight mode, basically tries its best to protect the person against reappearance or re-experience of that trauma. So that will include avoiding anything that can resemble the trauma, anything that could relate to it, anywhere that this can happen to me again. Frequent nightmares, flashbacks, difficulty trusting people, anger, always being on the edge. It's like the person is in the combat zone, and at any moment, someone can come out of a shadow and shoot at them. So the brain goes to this survival mode at the expense of being able to focus on academic functions, being able to perform, being able to concentrate, being able to interact with others, being able to see the beauties around what is around them. Because when one is in the combat zone, they don't care about the flowers; they care about staying alive.
Mm-hmm.
And that limits, and especially in childhood, which is the time that the person needs to interact with the outside world to learn about it and develop skills and build social skills, this can be very devastating. Besides that, and when we talk about PTSD, it doesn't mean it's not like one either does have PTSD or not have PTSD. Basically, let's say from 0 to 100 level of severity of all these symptoms that I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
we in the clinic to understand each other's language, draw a line at 70% and say, okay, whoever is above 70%, we call them PTSD. Doesn't mean that a person who is a 68 or 65% does not have symptoms. So those symptoms are still there. Depression is another effect. Anxiety is another effect. And unfortunately, for a child starting to experiment with the world, it becomes substance use to try to self-medicate with these issues. But then as these kids grow into adults, and when they become parents themselves, number one is that kids who have experienced these traumas in their childhood, they are more prone to developing PTSD as adults if they are exposed to the trauma. There are also epigenetic changes that happen, changes in methylation of genes that change the behavior and make the person more prone to effects of the trauma in adulthood. Then comes also a lot of physical conditions. Besides the depression and PTSD and anxiety, there is also obesity, cardiovascular illness, autoimmune diseases, all these other physical symptoms, which are the effect of continuous and chronic exposure to stress hormones and sympathetic and stress systems of the body being active are very common.
Well, I wondered if it matters if it's a natural disaster, say like the tornadoes in Dayton on Memorial Day versus man-made disasters like a shooting.
That's an excellent question. So it seems like when you look at the prevalence data of impact of trauma, the closer and the more man-made the traumatic experience is, the higher the prevalence of PTSD becomes. Mm. Meaning that when it is natural disasters, the impact of trauma is lower. There still is PTSD develops in a group of people, but the percentage of people who do develop PTSD is lower. But when it comes to man-made events like assault, shooting, robbery, rape, and these mass shootings, yes, the prevalence is higher.
Do we know why?
Well, not very clearly, but part is that it is man-made, we are basically social creatures, and we base this relationship on trust of our conspecifics, the other human who is part of our group and society. So we are inherently built to trust each other and our tribe mates. And when they do this to us, that's a big shock. And also a social trauma, we are also wired to be very aware of the negative social interactions. A very simple example, if you put a person in a scanner, in the brain scanner, and show them a picture of just a black and white picture, no gender, a picture of an angry or fearful face, the amygdala, which is the fear circuit part of the brain, the emotional part of the brain, lights up just looking at that face. Hmm. We're very well attuned, because we are social, to any negative affect coming from other humans. So that could be part, that we are very sensitive to any trauma coming from humans. But the other possibility is that when natural disasters happens, we all are in the same boat and we are helping each other. But when it's other people doing this to us, a part of that group coherence is damaged. These are the possibilities that could be causing that a level of difference in terms of the impact.
Hmm. We're talking about the cultural change that occurs after the 20 years since the mass shooting at Columbine High School and gun violence. My guest is Arash Javanbak. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry at Wayne State University in Michigan. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Metal detectors, police officers, see-through backpacks, run-hide-fight training, school administrators have embraced all of these strategies and more since 1999 when two students killed 12 of their classmates and a teacher at a Colorado high school. The idea is to prevent more shootings and ease the anxiety of students and their parents. But a recent study out of the University of Chicago revealed that most parents are still worried. We're talking about the long-term effects of a school shooting and how they've changed as a whole our culture. Still with us by phone is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Wayne State University in Michigan, where he studies the negative effects of trauma and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, Arash Javanbak. Randolph Roth is a professor of history and sociology at Ohio State and co-founder of the Historical Violence Database. He joins us as well. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Professor Randolph, age matters when it comes to an experiencing a traumatic event like this. You know, we were talking about it earlier. Mm-hmm. It used to be that children were pretty sheltered from it. And now, as we were talking about earlier, they're frontline exposed to it because they're being trained to avoid it.
Well, I think, you know, in some ways, I can even speak about my father's experience in the 1930s. Kids who live in violent neighborhoods have always been exposed to this. My father, when he looked at this whole issue, he grew up in one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in America, Globeville in Denver, as a poor immigrant kid. And they had to take knives to school all the time. And he laughed at metal detectors. He said, "You don't take your knives to school to fight at school. You take them there to get home. You take
alive.
Them to get to school." So he had, you know, he had this whole collection of fighting knives. And I do think it affected him his whole life. To have to go around with a 5-inch switchblade everywhere he went in high school and middle school and having those dirk knives, you know, on his ankle. And so this kind of thing happens. And our kids are very aware about how violent our society is. I think about our son here, of course, went to Chapman Elementary, a wonderful school. And they taught him, I guess in the fourth grade, they were teaching him about conflict management. So in other words, they had this little song that said, you know, if you're feeling sad and someone makes you mad, use a word. And he told us all about it on the way home. He's in fourth grade because he said, we rewrote the song on the bus home. You know, if you're feeling sad, someone makes you mad, use a gun. And they thought this was hilarious. They're totally aware of what's going on in the society.
And you know, Arash, Randolph just mentioned the idea of where his dad grew up, and it's like suburban kids in quote unquote nice schools are feeling something that other kids have grown up like Randolph Roth's father their whole lives.
So there's a difference when it comes to different areas of the city and different socioeconomic groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're, in reality, we know because of actually what Randolph mentioned, and actually there are long-term impacts in the lives of children who come from those neighborhoods. Part is now, we also know there's a higher level of trauma. There's much higher level of exposure to trauma, much higher level of PTSD, depression, anxiety. And substance use always follows because a lot of times it's a way of like self-medicating the person. But and more importantly, one of the things that Randolph said that I triggered me was in a positive way was, so he said that changed his dad's behavior or worldview for a long time. Yeah, so when as a child I grow in a neighborhood, in an environment where I am constantly exposed to the possibility of something going wrong, that's the way I will start to see the world. That's the way I will start to react and interact with the world. Let me just actually, this reminded me of a very interesting study that we had at University of Michigan several years ago. So there were two groups of people where they were during the childhood. One were from low socioeconomic, like poor families, the other were mid-class families, just the income, just that the income was different. Now they're adults, and all are healthy adults, mentally healthy, and socioeconomically are at the relatively the same level. The example that I used earlier, putting the person in the scanner and showing them a face, an angry or a fearful face, when that was presented to these kids, to these adults who were kids then, now the ones who come from the lower income families had a larger emotional reaction in the brain, which the person may not even be aware of, to the negative, to the angry and to the fearful faces at a cost of lower response to happy faces, which is adaptive, which is totally adaptive and understandable. The person prepares for a more hostile world. But the other kids who have not been exposed to it, when they are exposed, one disadvantage they may have is lack of preparation, lack of exposure, because it's just like the element of surprise. Because when it comes to fear and trauma, unpredictability and lack of control are extremely important. If this has never happened to me, and it just happens that full-blown, without any previous exposure, chances are I may get even more hurt.
And that's kind of the way it always is. Is it not, Randolph Roth, in the United States with these mass shootings? How many times do you read, I never thought it would happen to me. That always happens in another neighborhood. That's happened somewhere else. You know, who would think it would happen at a concert on a beautiful night in Las Vegas or wherever it might be, or a school in Connecticut in a classroom of first graders?
Well, they're awfully unpredictable. And when you think about it, I was just looking last night at the latest version of the Washington Post database on school shootings. And what's amazing to realize is we've only had five that have taken more than five lives. We've had eight that have taken between two and five. And so that's 13. And we're trying to explain 13 events as sociologists, which is hard. And so it is like getting struck by lightning. You know, the real, and again, it's not that I want to diminish the impact of the school shootings, but the kinds of violence that our students are experiencing, which is intense, is mostly after hours, right after school, you know, 3 to 5 in the afternoon. And that has a tremendous effect on our students. But I do think that the anxiety is there, and it's in some ways it's a positive thing. We know that Americans and parents are far more concerned about safety, and our society is. And we've seen a dramatic decline in accidental deaths of children over the last 60, 70 years. And that's because of technology and improved car safety. But really there is a real impact that parents are concerned. And we do protect our children more. Some people, there is an argument whether we go to excess. But I think that what you can see is that it's a trade-off. You know, parents were less vigilant, but we had a lot more deadly accidents involving children. So I think, you know, we have to think about it. You know, it's one of those trade-off issues. But I am concerned about how, you know, we are more anxious than we should be, but in other ways, we're not as vigilant as we should be. All of the experts that I've read said, you know, when our children, especially young men, need to talk when their friends start to talk this way about violence. And most of these school shootings that have been prevented, it's because the female friends have gotten in. There's kind of a gendered thing here going on about the young boys not wanting to tell or thinking it's just idle talk or we're just being macho. And I think that's where we really should really talk to our children about that, particularly our sons and daughters, and ask them, you know, to really, if you, as the cliche is, see something, hear something, say something.
I'm glad you brought that up. But for first, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the impact on our culture as a whole, given all of these shootings over the past 20 years since the Columbine event. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard Randolph Roth. He is a professor of history and sociology at Ohio State, and he's co-founder of the Historical Violence Database. Also with us by phone is Arash Javanbach. He is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Wayne State University in Michigan, and he studies these issues. Now I lost my train of thought. What you just said.
What did I just say?
Arash, jump in.
Yeah.
I think Randolph, you raised a very, very important point that there's tons of shooting happening every day in this country.
Yeah.
And we only get excited or buzzed or get the news highly about when it's a mass shooting.
Yeah.
I'm not denying, like you, I'm not denying the importance of paying attention to the mass shootings. But I think media has a role here into that. Well, if one person shot one person on this corner of the street of Chicago, that may not be too much news, exciting news for the media. But when events like this happen, those are things that can spend, like, I don't know, the cable news can spend hours and days on them, and they can stir emotions. And anything that stirs our emotions, whether positive or negative, brings us on to listen. Let me be honest. These days, in the political sphere and all these negative news that we are always hearing, one of my suggestions to my patients as psychiatrists, those who are very politically stressed, is that please just listen to NPR or BBC. Because these tell you the facts. Don't do like, because there is a lot of disaster pornography in the media.
Yeah.
That can lead to an overestimation of the level of danger. But at the same time, if there was a possibility to know where or what or who is dangerous, it would be easier to avoid them and be less worried, right? If, let's say, they say, my neighborhood in this corner, there is some very dangerous person who does never leave that corner. Well, I would just avoid that corner and I would always feel comfortable. But now every time one of these mass shootings happens, a lot of times you hear other people say, well, this person didn't look abnormal. They didn't do anything wrong. They were looking like a nice person. So what does that tell the people? They tell the people that the person sitting next to you could be that shooter in a month, telling them that you cannot predict at all. There's no way you can say who's going to do it. It's not predictable. It's not. You have no control over it. And as I said before, a very important element in development of trauma and fear is lack of control and uncertainty. But the other part is also the trauma in the parents. Actually, I was looking at a report that when the mass shootings in schools happen, parents also too develop PTSD. Because PTSD is not only, or other consequences of trauma don't only happen to the person who was involved, only happen to the victim. Mm-hmm. They also happen to the people who were nearby. Like if there was a school shooting in one class, people in the next class or the class after were also exposed to the trauma and have a chance of developing all the consequences that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
The first responders who come in there will have the chance of developing all of that. And we also have evidence that people hearing about it, people in the neighborhood, who are the closer the proximity, the worse, the higher the chance of trauma, because you are close to it. We were earlier
it could have been
about,
you, yeah.
Exactly. Earlier we were talking about it being a concept to most of us until it becomes real. So the closer you are to it, whether it's closer to the people that it has happened to, or closer physically you are, the more emotions get involved and the more real it gets. But still, parents who even hear about this happening to other parents' kids will have a high level of anxiety, and they transfer and translate that to their children too.
Yeah, you wrote something that you wrote it for the conversation, I think it was you, that humans are evolved to be very sensitive to social cues and have survived as a species, particularly because of the ability to fear as a group. And I thought that was kind of interesting, that concept, Arash.
Yes, we are. I strongly believe that we are tribal animals. And sometimes we are tribal in a good way. And sublimate that part of us. Well, let's say we cheer for different teams, and the extremes of being tribal is like fascism and racism and being against a group of people that we have never met. So the group is very important to us, and the consistency and cohesion of the group is important. So when there is another way of mass shooting affecting, maybe when we see the group is now unsafe, the group is intact. Number one, all our group can be eliminated because there's one person with a gun who can shoot at all of us. Number two, some members of the group that I feel I belong to can do this to me. So now it's not as easy, because a lot of times the tendency is to make it binary, right? Like the racism or nationalism, that other nation or group or race is the bad people, we all are good. But now people from inside of us are doing us. That creates a lot of confusion within the tribe that makes it harder mm-hmm. to not be anxious.
And that's when we're dealing with these externalities. We don't know what's inside someone's head. Professor Randolph, your research shows that mass shooters and homicides are motivated, and homicidal murders mm-hmm. are motivated by different things.
Yeah.
And that's further confusing us.
Well, it's confusing us. And I think I really support what my colleague is saying here. One of the things that's very difficult about the mass shootings compared to the others.
Just armed robbery.
There's so much. The thing is that often, you know, these are people who really don't know people well. And you know, they're killing people who they have only casual interaction with, or they don't know at all. And the thing that's hard about it is that part of the reason those people are targeted is because they're happy, and these people are angry.
Yeah.
And so they go after people who are happy, who are loved, who are accepted, and who are leading positive lives. And so there's this kind of sense of the tremendous wrongness of it. But again, you know, our society is tremendously hard on people who fail. And very many people who we would not think of as failing consider themselves failures in our society because the expectations are so high. And when you add that to the emotional inexperience of young people, and you add it, usually with these school shooters, there's always, it's not simply their anxiety about where they are in the social hierarchy, that they feel they're not respected, they're not included, they're not empowered. There's a lot of half of the cases we know of romantic rejection happened within the previous few weeks. But so emotional inexperience about recovering from those things are. But secondly, you know, when we do the forensic psychology afterwards, they find that a large number of these young people are suffering from the early onset schizophrenia. They're suffering from severe depression. They are suffering from antisocial disorder.
But those things have always been around.
Absolutely.
So what's the difference?
Well, you know, part of it is firepower. You know, I think that there's no question that you can do what you can do with a 33-round clip with a 45 automatic, as we saw in Virginia, is quite clear. And again, you know, I don't want to, you know, cause and effect is a tough thing. We know that if you use a standard, you commit a mass murder with a standard weapon, a revolver or a shotgun, the average number of killed and wounded is 6. If you use a semi-automatic handgun, the average number killed or wounded is 13. And if you use a semi-automatic rifle, is 24. So, you know, and again, you could say, well, they armed up because they wanted to kill more people. But I think that technology is really an issue here, too.
We are going to continue.
Believe,
yeah, go ahead, Arash.
Yeah, yeah. So I think what I can add here is that, so number one, when it comes to mental health, well, we have the same prevalence of mental health in all the whether severe or not, less severe of psychiatric conditions across the globe, but this is a problem that is happening in this country. And I think with all the weaknesses that Randolph mentioned about the person who would grab a gun and start to go kill someone or kill a group of people, so that extremely weak and basically pushed down person now has access to extreme power. Like, looking at, like, let's go 1,000 years ago and tell a person that you will have a stick in your hand with which you can kill people who are distant from you at the rate of like 50 in a minute. That's amazing. So extremely amazing power to a very powerless person could be very deceitful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is both psychologically and in terms of the effect, because that person, if they didn't have a gun, What would be the worst case they could do? They could get in a fist fight and beaten up, or they could grab a knife and the knife would be found right after they try to attack the first person. But with the gun, they not only symbolically are overcoming all those weaknesses, but also now have the power.
Okay.
We have to take a break. We'll be right back. That's Arash Javanbach. He is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Wayne State University. Randolph Roth is going to hold his thought there. He's a professor of history and sociology at Ohio State and co-founder of the Historical Violence Database. And we're going to hear from a guidance counselor who is at Chardon High School when the shooting occurred there in 2012. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the long-term effects of school shootings and other mass shootings and how they can change our brains, how they have affected our culture. Still with us by phone is assistant professor of psychiatry at Wayne State University, where he studies the negative effects of this kind of trauma and PTSD, Arash Javanbach. Also, professor of history and sociology at Ohio State and co-founder of the Historical Violence Database, Randolph Roth. Nicole Hetrick is a guidance counselor at Chardon High School in Northeast Ohio. She was the counselor there in 2012 when a student shooter took the lives of three classmates. And Nicole Hetrick joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's been 7 years since the Chardon shooting. And tell us about the day the shooting took place and what your interactions were with the students, that kind of immediate impact it had.
Wow. It all comes back in a lot of ways. Of course, shock and everything else. And I was actually, at the time I was leaving, I was literally walking out of the building en route to go to the middle school for a meeting. And we went ahead not knowing that was happening at that moment, so we went over to the middle school. And we were in kind of a different perspective. The middle school is right across the street, so it's right nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And we start getting phone calls, and there were a bunch of kids, students who had run from the high school, and they had come over there to the middle school. And at the time, you know, they were frantic to sharing what they saw happening, and we didn't know that one of the students who had actually been hit, kind of just nicked with the bullet, was actually over there with us, but we didn't even actually realize that at the time. But I also had a daughter in the building at the time, so the frantic moments, it's so hard to put to words the actual moments and the feelings and everything else, and you know, and of course, as the day played out. You know, it was obviously a very long day of evacuating and getting students reunited with parents, and that was I think that helped distract, and you know, because it kept us very busy, is helping students reunite with parents and putting a process in place to make all that happen and to account for everybody. That was a big chunk of it.
You know, since then, I've mentioned in the last few segments all the different strategies that schools have adapted along a continuum, given where they're at and maybe the resources they have. But
right.
How has it changed Chardon schools?
I think for us, and we debate this and discuss it. I mean, we've added an SRO, which is, of course, a common approach. We have not.
What's an SRO? I'm sorry.
School resource officer.
Gotcha.
Okay, sorry about that.
No problem.
We haven't taken drastic measures. I mean, we've put things in place. We do have a check-in system with visitors and guests, and we've had annual staff trainings and drills. But we were doing training and drills prior. But I think for us, the biggest thing that has changed is the community and the sense of community, the amount of support our students see on a day-to-day basis. The culture in our school has changed significantly.
For the better?
Absolutely, yes. And we always had these students with the issues they have and things like that, but we are so much better able to serve and identify their needs and really show these students how much we care about them. And I think that's a positive change out of it. Security changes can only be so effective, and so that's where we debate the security changes. We put in the things in place that we know we needed to put into place, but we really have focused on culture change and community. And it's having worked here. I've been here for 23 years, and we are so much more caring with our students, and we make sure all of our students know that they matter and things like that. And getting to helping them with their needs early on, and we've done a great job with that, with the help of social workers and some other people who have worked with us.
Yeah. Well, Arash Javanbak, is this the good kind of outcome?
Actually, thank you very much, Nicole. Looking at the article on the conversation you were mentioning about the mass shooting. Mm-hmm. And the last section, actually, I'm just going to read that as the answer. As a group mm-hmm. species, we are able to consolidate group dynamics and integrity when pressured and stressed, so we may raise a more positive sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
So yeah. It helps us, yes. So now there's that mutual thing that we hate, the enemy,
right.
That the things that bother us, the thing that attack us, and now part of the revenge is the solidarity and mm-hmm. growing together and right. Being able to rise against it, because the intention of that event was to destroy us, and now we mm-hmm. group together against it, and now we also understand the importance of being alive and the joy more.
Right.
Because so there is a possible, there are possible positive outcomes here. There are another beautiful encounter. The example was when there was a shooting at the synagogue, and then you saw Muslim community mm. coming to the Jewish community and trying to help each other in this like divisive atmosphere. So these beauties that can bring the people together to stand mm-hmm. against what is seen as the evil or what is seen as the wrong. Yeah, yeah, I totally understand it, and I very much admire it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to add to that, one of the approaches, many of our staff who are still here, and one of the things we've all said is that we are not going to let that person who committed that heinous act have any more power over us. We're gonna, and so as a community, as a Chardon, as a high school community, as a city, we are not going to give that person take anything more from us. And
you know,
that's huge.
It is huge, and I'm kind of wondering. You make me think about the victims in Las Vegas at that concert. People came from all over the country, but mostly the West Coast, granted, but there mm-hmm. were people there from Ohio. I mean, they were from all over, and I wonder, mm-hmm. you know, if any of you have some thoughts about how, you know, it's different then. You're more isolated, are you not, Arash?
Oh, in a situation yeah. like that, yeah, you're going to be more, you're going to go back to, and you're not going to have people. We had an entire city that rallied, and we're still all together. It's an interesting point, because after an event like that, they go back to their homes and they don't have that support with them.
That's true, but at the same time, there is a possibility of getting mm-hmm. the support, which mm-hmm. would be whether you have a therapist or a psychiatrist that provides
support.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Or there are groups like, I mean, unfortunately, these events happen everywhere. So let's mm-hmm. say one of them was from Michigan and comes back to Detroit. There are groups that people who have gone through similar experiences can get together and discuss. Right. But yeah, that's totally right, because you guys share a lot more than mm-hmm. just the shooting that happened.
Right.
You share history together. You share culture. You share interests. You share the buildings that you all have seen, the places that you have you have had the ice cream. So that you can use all of those factors of resilience to stand stronger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I absolutely agree. But people just have to know how to access the resources that are available as well.
And it is important to mention that we talk about all these devastating effects of trauma, including PTSD or depression, that can like really disable a person. But the good news is that we have treatments. We have effective treatments for these conditions. So we can do a lot for people
absolutely.
Who are traumatized.
Yeah, Randolph Roth?
I was thinking about, you know, how important it is, as we're saying, that people at the school understand and respond to these challenges that they face. I just was reviewing a grant proposal from a study that's ongoing of a northeastern urban charter school, and about during the time that the researcher was there as a participant observer, as a teacher, they had three. She wanted to study the impact of this loss of a student, and they lost three in just 2 years in this small school. And the thing was, she felt that the faculty and the administration didn't understand how long it took the young people to recover. Mm. She's really studying grieving rituals and how they differ by class and by culture, and how the school was tolerant about the young people acting out about the loss of their friends for the first week. And then they crack down on them. And it takes longer. And also noticed that, and so she's trying to figure out, she's really writing about the culture of grieving in this city, about how the young people won't verbalize. They will use art. They will use rap. They will use music, other kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And they won't express it, but they'll act out in ways that are counterproductive in school. The other thing is that as when we're talking about individual treatment of students, which is really what you're saying here, some of the students double down and become more dedicated to their studies because they just want to get out.
Yeah,
I mean, that was my dad did. And other kids, really, when this happens, they tank. And how do you respond to that as a faculty when you see these students who were formerly decent students spiraling down?
And Nicole Hetrick, I mean, is there still reverberations from the 2012 incident?
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's a couple generations of students ago, but.
Right. Well, and we have siblings in our building and, of course, faculty and just, you know, a multiple reason. To the point here is from just a minute ago, grieving and allowing students to grieve and understanding individual needs. Our shooting happened in February. August and September, going into that next school year, were absolutely horrific for us. You go through that grieving process immediately. Coming back to school that next fall was terrible. We had suicide attempts. Mm. We had a parent who killed herself the next November. It was, so to that point, grieving has to be respected in any way, shape, or form. And in whatever time frame people, whether it be students, parents, adults, community, in whatever time frame they need, I can't even say enough about the importance of that. So that's just, I want to make sure I stress that as well. So,
yeah.
That is extremely important to let people grieve the way, because we have individual differences in the way we can let things go. And even with that, not every two people who were there had the same experience. They were having the experience where from a very different angle, different distance, different perception and cognition and processing that they bring to the story. But besides the grieving, there's also like the real conditions of PTSD and depression and anxiety and potential substance use, that those need treatment. We can't just let them happen. And I'm glad that there are resources available for those. And when it comes to some like non-productive behavior, I want to emphasize that irritability, anger, aggression, violence, a lot of times is the other side of the fear. When a cat is cornered, it looks angry. The more you corner it, the angrier it will be. And that anger is a sign of fear. the same sort of happens to us humans. So a big chunk of the symptoms of PTSD actually is anger, is irritability, is opposition, because the person is trying to regain that control that they lost. So understanding these kind of behaviors in that light can also be helpful in empathizing with the person.
Arash Javanbach, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Wayne State University, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Also, Nicole Hetrick, Guidance Counselor at Chardon High School in Northeast Ohio. Really appreciate your insights. Thank you so much.
No problem.
And Randolph Roth, Professor of History and Sociology at OSU. He's co-founder of the Historical Violence Database. As always, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.